Good morning and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. With me in the studio today are two very special guests. Once again, Lydia Black, visiting professor of anthropology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And with her today is Larry Merkuliev, who is president of the Aleut Corporation, which, will you please pronounce it for me so I don't mash it?
It's the Village Corporation on St. Paul, Tanahusik.
Once again.
Tanahusik. Say TDX.
TDX. Very wonderful sounding language.
Yeah, it is. It's very melodic, and some parts of it very guttural too.
Could you say a few things for?
Well, one of the things that I said in the film that was shown last night at the museum, "Unang Tanahue, Tanahi Tohtakoking," meaning this is Aleut land, and we love it.
Wonderful, sort of rhythm.
Yeah.
Cadence in the language.
There is that cadence, and it's very soft-spoken language, too.
And there are also three kinds of speech: polite, ordinary, and rude.
Yeah, that's true.
When you first were in the Aleutians in 75, which language did you hear most frequently, or did you begin to learn?
I began to learn. I have not learned it yet because I never can spend enough time in a village to hear the language constantly.
You learn the polite form?
Ordinary. And polite.
Ordinary and polite, not the rude.
No.
They don't teach you that.
And sometimes the boundary line between the three different forms are very subtle. So it's very easy to make a mistake.
As in English.
Oh,
well,
yes.
It's because the pronunciation is the thing that changes the form, or is it different vocabulary?
If I may put on my anthropological hat,
please
in
do.
Pre-conduct times, in Eastern Aleutians, where the society was ranked, they were nobles and commoners and slaves, the polite form of speech was used by the socially inferior towards socially superior.
So it was a part of a demonstration of the power structure.
That is right. In the ordinary intercourse, people used what is termed ordinary speech.
And in terms of modern-day times, those distinctions are not there, the distinction in terms of treatment of people in the way you use the language is still definitely there.
Is it a difficult language to learn?
I don't know. You'd have to ask somebody who's going to be studying that language.
For me, phonology is rather difficult because phonological distinctions between the final consonants like H and H and K and what we in writing indicate by the letter Q, those are very difficult for me to master. If I started learning Aleut as a child, I probably would speak it well. Mm-hmm. But look at my English. I have been here for 35 years. I still have an accent.
Are there many non-native Aleut speakers of your language?
I don't think so. There might be two or three. Unless Dr. Black, do you know of anyone else? I think there are about a couple. Mm-hmm. But I haven't met a non-Aleut that can speak it fluently yet.
How about your own people? How well is the language being retained? That is a consideration for...
Well, you know, St. Paul is the largest Aleut village in the world. And as
what is
such,
the population?
550. And as such, it's really a cultural stronghold in that sense. And a lot of it is due to just the sheer numbers of people. And most of the people there, particularly from ages 40 on up, would speak it extremely fluently. And when you get to the 60-year age group, they would speak more of what we would call the deep Aleut, which is more of the original type Aleut. And in between would be Aleut mixed with a lot of Russian words.
So the language was heavily influenced by the Russian period in history.
Oh, yes, there's no question.
Well, in any context situation, when new items of material culture and concepts are introduced or people in a society become aware of foreign concepts or items, very often the nomenclature travels with the concept or item.
But it was not simply a vocabulary change.
No, it is not vocabulary change. It's linguistic borrowing, and the Russian vocabulary that has been adopted into Aleut language has been changed to conform to phonology and grammatical structure of the Aleut language. It is not a simple taking over vocabulary change. No way. It is just new linguistic items are added, which are derived from the Russian language, but they're changed into the phonology and grammar of the Aleut language.
Yeah, and many of that, it's very true, much of that was foreign elements, foreign items being brought into the country that historically never was there, and so consequently there were no Aleut words for it.
Like tea.
Yes.
and all of the customs and habits that revolve around drinking tea. And that, in fact, a simple product like that can really make a cultural change in terms of habits,
the way people
celebrate, the way they take breaks, and so on.
I must say that Aleut language is not unique. All of the languages of Alaska, including languages of the people who theoretically were not in contact with the Russians in the century that they ruled Alaska, have Russian vocabulary. Even Inupiat and Koyukon and the languages of interior Athabascan have at least a few loan words from the Russian.
Let's talk a little bit, for the sake of our listeners, about what you know of the Aleut way of life prior to contact with the Russians. The Aleutian, as Lydia and I discussed before, we have some difficulty grasping how distant it is from the rest of the state of Alaska, even when we have a fairly good grasp of distances. This is the part of the map that's cut off and sort of inserted at the bottom, and so we don't get a sense of the spread and the real isolation that your people had from.
And the population of Aleutian Archipelago, on the basis of language, had a common origin, with possible exception of the westernmost islands on Attu, of which language we know very little, and which was very different from the dialects of the Aleut spoken to the east of near islands or even Rat Islands. We don't know much about Rat Island, their speech at all. It seems it was a sub-dialect of the western Aleut. What is common to all the people is, of course, the adaptation to exploitation of the resources of the sea. The Aleuts lived by the sea. Marine mammals, fish, and marine birds were their main resource for technology, clothing, and for food, of course. They were divided into a number of political units, which I call polities, and the boundaries were rather sharply drawn. They were external markers of differences in patterns of tattoo, in the items of personal adornment, in hairdo, in clothing. Even to this day, people in Umnak will tell you that the Atkan warriors color their kamlekas, the waterproof shirts, red, and so you always knew when you met at sea an Atkan raiding party.
Yeah, Larry, I think one thing that really also distinguishes the culture and subcultural activities out in the Aleutians is the fact that they're island cultures. And that is what probably distinguishes it from much of even coastal Alaska.
This is true. The reliance on the sea was much greater than anywhere else.
Do you have stories about early contact?
There are stories that are passed on. And, of course, the most famous one, I guess, was the point in time when, at least this was what I had heard, the contact time when the Russians first came. And these were really independent Russian fur traders. This point, and I don't know if Dr. Black can reference the specific historical point about how many Aleuts can a musket ball kill. And so what the Russian did was line up the Aleuts chest to back, and I believe the figure was 9.
Well, this story is, of course, a mythological one. It is ascribed in legend and by 1828 to a man named Ivan Solovyov, who was in the islands first in 1759 and got along quite well. In 1765, he brought the Aleuts down to their knees by destroying their baidarkas, and those destroying their means of making a living in retaliation for Aleut destruction of four Russian ships the previous summer. However, the first historical notation of this appears in Martin Sauer, who was in the islands in 1790 as a secretary to Captain Billings of the Russian naval expedition. And interestingly, he doesn't ascribe it to Solovyov, but to Grigory Shelikhov on Kadyak. Mm-hmm. This is why I think the story is apocryphal. And it was published quite early in Russia. By 1812, it was in a book published in Russia. And I think it spread from there. I don't know if it ever occurred. Captain Ismailov, testifying before Captain Sarachev and Billings on Kodiak, claimed that this never occurred and that Shelikhov much exaggerated the casualties and that the fight was dirty and nasty on Kodiak, but that such an atrocity never occurred. I don't think we can ever know.
No, I don't want to try to prove it.
A similar story has been ascribed to some Europeans in Africa at about the same time. So it's
one of those stories that tours the world and changes
right.
Depending on where it is.
Yeah.
What was the we have fairly isolated populations, fairly small communities, separated by sea and living quite a rugged life. The climate out there is fairly extreme. Heavy winds?
Well, it's not extreme, but there are certainly high winds. I mean, the Aleutians are called the birthplace of the winds. And the temperatures probably wouldn't range any more than 20 degrees above zero most of the time, and then no higher than 55 degrees in the summertime, Fahrenheit. And that's because of the Japanese current, which runs along the Aleutian chain and keeps the temperature fairly moderate. But what does bring the cold to the area are the high winds. And of course, we always say that the wind or the snow and the rain fall sideways. And what we call high winds, we had our record winds on St. Paul Island, I think, 3 years ago, and it was 150 knots. And we call them high winds. In Hawaii, they'd be hurricanes.
it's all relative. A little breeze in Fairbanks seems like enough to blow you over. And, in Oklahoma, I know we were much more tolerant of pretty stiff breezes. But with the sea and with the wind, would you describe it as a rugged life?
You mean historically? Historically, there's no question that from the history as we see it, there certainly were some periods of extreme hardships, particularly in the late winter months, around February, March. In fact, when you look at the Aleut calendar and the interpretation of it, I think it was the month of March that is the month for eating straps. So that indicated that at least that period of time was extremely hard. And the winter months, of course, in the entire Aleutians, in the winter months, these we have, because of the winds, a lot of high seas. Very difficult to use the traditional Ulochtans or Badarkas, as they're referred to in many of the books, out in those kinds of oceans. And most of the seals and sea lions have moved further south during the winter time, and most of the ducks are also gone, except for the very southern parts of the Aleutian chain, or the southwestern parts, I'd say.
Okay. The well-being, then, of the people is tied to certain animals and their migrations. What are those, and how?
Okay, well, there's a saying that is touted in these today, and I don't know if that has any origins way back, but it certainly makes sense. When the tide is out, the table is set, meaning, of course, that there's a lot of interaction with the intertidal zone along the islands, and definitely a lot of activity with sea otters, sea otter hunting, the fur seals whenever they were migrating through the passes, which would be around April and May, and sea lions.
And you have ways of preserving those harvests so that they sustain the people for some time, or is it sort of feast and famine?
Well, if I think from the historical accounts, they're outside of drying the products. There was very little other means to really store the foods, and I think that probably was true until the Russians arrived and brought salt.
That's correct. On Attu, the Attuans adopted use of salt, because watching the Russians preserve the meat of sea lions, and they produced salt on the spot. They boiled the salt out of seawater on Attu, and the Aleuts very quickly adopted that method of food preservation, also smoking.
What were the boats made out of that they used?
Well, like the Baidars, which are a larger craft, were used to move families from one hunting camp to another, and they were made out of mostly sea lion skins, and parts of various parts of the seal's body, membranes, and that kind of thing. And Doctor, why don't you explain some of the detailed aspects of it?
Both the Baidara, which is a large Umiak type craft, and the kayak, the Baidarka, they were very sophisticated watercraft. The wooden frame was made of specific kinds of driftwood, and they were so made as to be flexible, movable, which gave the craft a greater stability in a rough sea and swells. The kayaks were also watertight. The hunters used drip skirts of seal skin, made of sea mammal intestines, to cover the hatch so that not a drop of water entered. They had a very sophisticated equipment, like a pump used in Archimedes' principle, vacuum. They used seal floats, entire seal skin, skillfully removed and inflated. In the storm, for example, the kayaks would be lashed together, but to prevent damage, a seal float or a series of seal floats would be in between. Also, sometimes seal floats were used for a hunter for either to right an overturned kayak or to repair slide damage. But nevertheless, it was a very dangerous enterprise in rough waters to sail by Darka.
Yes, and they were truly one of the most advanced craft of their type in the North American continent at their time. And I found it interesting a couple of years ago that there was a British expedition of kayakers that moved from Vancouver, British Columbia, and went across the Gulf of Alaska down to Aleutian Chain. The style and model of craft they used to do that was the Aleut Ulochtan.
This is true. The Aleuts gave us the kayak because the Navy personnel of the Russians that arrived in 1769 for the first time, and the subsequent Navy expeditions, the Navy officers were much taken with it, and they made beautiful technical drawings of those craft and compared them with the kayaks used by the Kodiak people and so on. And the Aleuts gave us the kayak, and they also gave us our rain gear today, the waterproof. That comes directly from the Aleutian Islands, including the style with the hood, drawstrings around face and around the wrist.
So that's an Aleut design that we've taken over.
Correct. Correct. Later on, all the skippers of all the trading ships, no matter what nation, they tried to acquire the waterproofs made of sea mammal intestines here in Alaska for their crews.
Many times we only look at societies in terms of what effect Western exploring countries have on those communities. And in fact, it's very interesting to take a look at what effect the things that those travelers, early travelers, learned from the people that they encountered on their trips. And the Aleuts are certainly an excellent case in point. Always impressed when I go to the museums what varied and clever use is made out of those marine mammals. Just a wide, wide variety of equipment and protective gear and various decorations and so on from really limited resources, really creative imagination.
That's true. I think this is probably common to most cultures that have to live in environments that are extremely challenging to survival. And with limited resources, that, of course, requires the particular culture to use as much imagination and creativity as possible in order to survive with limited resources. I think that's probably true of the very northern Inuit Eskimos and, of course, the Aleuts being out in the very harsh conditions in the wintertime in the Aleutians.
Were you going to say something?
I was going to say it also requires great endurance and great understanding of the environment. And the endurance of Aleut man, and there was remarked in 1762 by Andriantel Stich, for whom the Andrianov segment of the Aleutian chain is now named on the maps. He said that to go out hunting far out to sea in the kayak was put a great strain and was a test of manhood. And he also says that after hours and hours in a kayak with legs outstretched in cold, damp weather, the men returning home could barely get out of and had to be warmed artificially. And I firmly believe that the enthusiastic acceptance of the Russian-type steam bath has something to do with it.
That's probably very true.
A real gift when that arrived. Okay, that is a really... both of your images have given me a real clear picture of that life prior to Russian contact. And I think that respect coming from someone who was obviously a very tough traveler himself is certainly not faint praise. When was the original Russian contact that your people record?
Well, in the very first one, and a very superficial one, as of course in 1741, and the second Bering expedition, where both the ships in Peter and St. Paul independently stopped off the Shumagin Islands and gave us the first drawings of an Aleut kayak. The Navy men were most impressed. But much more interesting to me, the same year, 1741, Captain Chirikov in the ship St. Paul stood off Adak. He was short on water. And a number of Aleuts came out by darkness to the ship, and Chirikov indicated that he wanted water. They paddled away and brought out the seal bladder containers of water, and they indicated that in return they wanted knives. They used the gesture indicating cutting a piece of food or blubber in front of one's mouth. Chirikov, who was from Kamchatka, understood the gesture, and bargaining proceeded. He offered a knife for 3 bladders of water, and the Aleut said, "No way, one knife per 1 bladder of water." He also exchanged the first Aleut bent wood helmet that we know of for an axe.
Heavy bargaining going on. What were they using for cutting tools prior to that?
And they used stone tools, but also they used iron. They knew iron way before the Russians came, and the iron came in the western and central Aleutians and in part in the east from various shipwrecks carried by Japanese current, preferably Japanese. One of early Russian fur traders, one Prokopy Lysenkov, says they prefer the Japanese wrecks to any other because Japanese nails are longer and broader. But they also probably got small quantity of iron through the Bering Strait native trade work. Iron probably traveled from China at the end of B.C.,
Were those regular trade routes or very sporadic, like years would go by between?
It was a regular trade route, but how much of the ironware that filtered from China to Bering Strait on the Asiatic side came down to Alaska, we don't know. However, Stepan Glotov, who was the first to visit Umnak and Unalaska, as far as we know, because the Russian skippers liked to keep something secret, what the government didn't know didn't hurt the government. But Glotta was the first to report the landfall in eastern Aleutians. He explicitly says that in part they get metal from wrecks and in part through the trade from the east. So he ought to know. He was a smart guy.
Mm-hmm. In the telling of early Russian contact by the Aleuts, were they friendly to the Russians?
I think some of the initial contacts probably could be characterized as that. And, of course, there were some instances that occurred throughout that in the initial 40, 50 years where some misunderstandings arose and some things resulted, like particularly in the major war, I guess you'd say, that occurred in 1765 in the Aleutians, where the crews of 3 Russian ships were, or 4 Russian ships, excuse me, were attacked by our people and resulted in the decimation of almost all the Russian crew members. And from that point on, it became, at least for a short period of time, by some individual leaders from the Russian fur traders that were over in our area, a reason to carry out attacks against the people.
This is true. The government prohibited violence, but again, what the government didn't know, they inherited
the Russian government.
Yes. And so if there were charges of violence, they tended to claim self-defense. That was one of those excuses.
How long were those trips when the Russians were out? Were they out 2 years at a time as some whaler expeditions?
Oh, yes. It depended. They started out for the Commander Islands, where they provisioned the ships with salted marine mammal meat. Those early skippers, they lived like the Aleuts. Same diet. And usually about half of their crews were Kamchatka natives, Kamchadal and Korek. And so they provisioned themselves with marine mammal meat on Commander Islands and hunted at the same time, because Commander Islands is a rookery of the fur seal and also rich in sea otter. And then they proceeded eastward. And we can't talk about the entire period because it changed with the time, the capitalization of the ships, the composition of the crews. The early ships had very poor armament. They were forbidden to carry cannon. They had very few firearms. Their weapon was a hand pike or lance. And Glotov, when he landed on Umnak, had a total of 6 muzzle loaders. Hardly a real an armory.
Arsenal.
Yes.
He didn't come prepared to fight.
Yeah. So, but later on, they changed, and in the beginning, it may be 2 years, 3 years. Then, as they become acquainted with the islands, they extend it, and there are some voyages that last 10 or 12 years.
So they're very isolated from the Russian government, any sort of central command.
And actually, they acquire local families, and they really don't want to go back. A lot of them, the record shows, they go back to Kamchatka, they sell their share of the catch because they hunted on shares, have a great big bash, and catch the next ship back to the islands.
Then they were. The Aleuts and the Russians were both interested in the fur harvest. Was there enough for both of them, both of those groups, or was there competition?
No, I think that after a period of time, most of the Aleut huntsmen were recruited by the Russian fur traders to take the furs pretty much for the Russian fur traders.
So they became like Hudson Bay, sort of brokering the furs?
Yes, in part, especially in the central and western Aleutians. What happened here, the fur of the sea mammals, sea otter and fur seals, was the dress of the women. Also, blankets were made of them. And it became possible to exchange them for metal tools and for various other commodities, and later on for money. Women's dress changed. It was a lucky woman who just had a puffin parka trimmed with sea otter or fur seal. The furs were exchanged first to independent traders, and later on, of course, they were delivered to the Russian-American Company after it became a monopoly in 1799.
So although they were harvesting the furs, they were getting so much in trade that they were reluctant to even use them and keep them themselves because they became that valuable.
It is a very complex subject because it was introduced cultural change. They wanted salt. They wanted metal. And then, of course, during the Baranov management, which is the darkest hour as far as Aleuts are concerned, in the eastern Aleutians, Baranov's arm did not reach into central Aleutians. But in the eastern Aleutians, Baranov, who was building an empire, and there were very few Russians, he had less than 300 of any ranks at any time. He needed not only labor force to support his enterprises. He needed fighters. So he impressed the people of Kodiak into his army because this horrendous 400, 500 kayak fleet that sailed to the Tlingit area, those were mainly people from Kodiak. But to replace the labor force on Kodiak, because the men were away, he then tried to impress the eastern Aleuts. And this is when in 1810 he ordered 200 Aleuts. That included their women and children with families, because they traveled with families, to be transported to the Pribilofs. The fur harvest was stopped for a time between 1806 and 1810. In 1810, Baranov decided to reactivate the fur harvest, and there were only 6 Russians altogether by that time on St. George and St. Paul, so he decided to settle Aleuts from Unalaska on the Pribilofs, and this is the beginning of the Aleut settlement on the Pribilofs.
So during that period, the Aleuts really did not have a lot of self-determination in terms of what was happening to them.
This is different by region. In the central and western Aleutians, the situation was very different. Around Unalaska and on the Shumagins, Baranov's hand lay very heavy.
Again, we have to keep in mind the vast distances there. What happens to one does not necessarily happen to the other.
That's true. It's a string of islands. It runs over 200 islands. It runs over 2,000 miles in length.
So you don't have necessarily a real common history with all of the other people.
No, yeah, that's true. I think each particular major island had their own distinct idiosyncrasies culturally, as island cultures do. Even 40 miles away, there could be distinct differences, even in inflection and language and certain local customs that are practiced in a particular community. Although the bases were still the same, the basis of the cultural aspects in terms of the technology used to survive at the time.
And in pre-contact times, there were also differences in religious orientation. For example, in the Eastern Aleutians, the shamans had very little to do with the lineage rituals and lineage worship. While in the central and western Aleutians, the shaman was central to the complex of religious expression. Eventually, with introduction of orthodoxy, which was done by laymen mostly, adherence to the Orthodox religion provided a unifying thread.
There were missionaries that came?
No, not really. The first, if you can call it, missionary was Ian Vinyaminov, who arrived in Unalaska in 1824, and by that time he was met by a community that firmly stated, "We are Christians."
So, I had read in the archives one time, I don't know if you would recall this, Doctor, a letter that was written by one of the Russian fur traders to Tsarina Catherine, asking that Russian priests be brought over, or Orthodox priests be brought over to the Aleutians, that one of the things that they wanted to do was to Christianize the people so that there would be less violence or opposition.
I think you're referring to Shelikhov's petitions. Shelikhov, who tried to gain advantage and get a monopoly from Catherine the Great, which he never did as long as she lived, because Catherine had a very cynical view of Shelikhov's protestations. This was one of the justification for his move. However, he did support the first mission to Kodiak, from which one member, Hieromonk Makary, was sent in 1795 to Unalaska. Incidentally, he traveled by kayak from Kodiak to Unalaska. Hmm. He was an ex-military man and rather hardy. And he was the one who organized the Aleuts, and with 10 Aleuts, four of whom were village chiefs, went to St. Petersburg to lodge complaints about activities of Shelikhov and the oppression of the Aleuts in the Eastern Islands by Shelikhov's men. Unfortunately, on his way back to Alaska, he was drowned in the wreck of the vessel Phoenix, which went down somewhere in Shelikhov Strait, last seen off Unimak Island, proceeding to Kodiak. And so there is this very short sojourn by Hieromonk Makary, who says that all the Aleuts are Christians by 1795. And then the first resident priest arriving at Unalaska in 1824, the first priest in the Aleutians in 1828, Yakov Nitsvetov, himself of Aleut origin, who grew up in St. George, was an ordinary sealer until about age 18 when he went to Irkutsk to enter seminary. The mystery to me is there is a vague mention of an old man in his 80s or 90s, an old-time Russian promyshlenik who conducted in his old age a school in St. George and educated Yakov Nitsvetov. Mm. I wish I knew more about this man, but the record is silent.
Mm. And there's a the speculation about, you know, why the LA people had grasped hold so thoroughly of the Orthodox religion. And looking at it, I think there were probably a lot of things that the LA people believed in their own religious practice at the time that was matched a lot of the things that the Orthodox religion had at the time.
That so is absolutely true. Father Veniamino remarked on it, and I myself in my own research, I see many, many correspondences in attitudes, in worldview, and in symbols.
So there, your traditional belief system was not altered that much, or at least it wasn't in conflict.
It was not in conflict. It meshed. I know that syncretism is used as a negative term. As an anthropologist, syncretism is a lifeline of humanity. Mm-hmm. This is, we adjust our ideas, preserving the old and taking from the new in a new configuration in order to survive in a new situation. And I think that's exactly what happened in the Aleutians.
And the only exception to that, I think, would be that shamanism, for example, wasn't condoned because that was seen as a conflict in terms of...
But Veniaminov accepted the shaman from the Krinitsyn Islands and said, "You heal by the power of God. You are one of us." Mm-hmm. He incorporated the shaman.
Yeah, he certainly did have a very open view about it. There's no question. Yeah.
So he incorporated the traditional beliefs into the
practice. He met with a shaman on Acuña Island, and they had a long conversation lasting for a couple of days, and at the end of which Veniaminov wrote to the bishop, "This man is a man of God, and I told him so. I told him that his healing power was from God."
Mm-hmm. The Russians were in the Aleutians for a total length of period. How many years?
Well, it depends where you want to begin. If you begin politically, the advent is dated to Bering's expedition 1741. Effectively, in the Eastern Aleutians, it would be late 1750s, early 1760s.
And ending when?
Ending in 1867, actual transfer being accomplished between October 1867 and sometime in 1868.
Yeah, it was the Treaty of Sessions.
And did that have a profound effect on life for the Aleuts?
Well, not so much for the people along the Aleutian chain, but certainly for the people in the Pribilof Islands, because one of the rationale for the Treaty of Sessions in the first place was because of the amount of revenues that were being generated by fur seal pelts. And, of course, when Alaska was bought for $7.2 million, the speculators believed that if they took over the fur seal operations on the Pribilofs, they would be able to recover that and more. And, in fact, historically, that's exactly what occurred. Well, when the federal government took over, the American government took over the Pribilof Islands jurisdiction, very shortly afterwards, they had leased out the rights to harvest fur seals to commercial companies. And that took place for a period of about 40 years up until the late 1800s. The federal government then took over direct jurisdiction of the Pribilofs, did not renew the commercial aspects of it by 1910.
And when the commercial companies took over, they abandoned all the conservation practices of the fur seal herd that were in place. Also, pelagic sealing under laissez-faire concepts was at its height until the 1911 International Convention on the Protection of the North Pacific.
In fact, if we were to compare the latter parts of Russian treatment of the Aleut people to that initial part of the American commercial companies, I think the Aleut people fared much less better at that point in time.
In other words, it was a decline in their sort of quality of life, at least initially.
There's no question that 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 occurred because the object of these commercial companies was to try to exploit the resource to its maximum degree. And the only ones that were expert and skilled at taking the fur seals in large numbers were our people. So consequently, these companies let the men work 7 days a week, and they were killing hundreds of thousands of seals a year.
Sort of into the modern efficiency mode.
And not thinking long-term
about the resource.
Yeah, and the men became so debilitated. The rations that were provided were inadequate for in terms of energy and the amount of energy required to work for these companies, that the men became debilitated at a very early age, to the point where they had to recruit, quote-unquote, fresh stocks from the Aleutians.
The population statistics, which are preserved in the church archives and the annual censuses, bear this out. For the first time in many years, in this 1880s, throughout the Aleutian chain, the gross death numbers are higher than the gross birth numbers, which in the latter part of the Russian period was the opposite. After an initial decline of Aleutian population, there was small but steady increase in the population.
In the Aleut population.
In the Aleut population. And after 1867, about, I would say, the 1880s were the worst, where, again, the ratios were reversed.
In terms of the population ratios, how many, what kind of balance was there when the Russians were there between the Aleuts and the Russian?
In 1867-68, there was a census conducted for the transfer of the territory. And on St. Paul, there was one Russian and several hundred Aleuts.
So Aleuts were definitely in the majority. Did that change after the
I think
transfer?
Mr. Merkulyov can answer that better than I.
Yeah, well, it changed a little bit, but in terms of numbers of non-Aleuts that were brought into the Pribilofs, it wasn't that significant. Certainly, there were fur seal agents that were recruited and also to act as teachers on the island. But it was a colonialistic system that was put in place for quite an extensive period of time out there in the Pribilofs. In fact, the real independence politically of our people did not occur until 1966. Up to that point, I think all aspects of the lives of our people were rigidly controlled, usually by just a handful of government agents.
And what is it like now? What?
Well, after
tell us a little bit about the life now and the economy now.
Well, after we achieved our political independence in 1966. And this was only after United Nations protest of the way that the U.S. government was treating our people in 1958 and Howard Rock publishing some letters smuggled out that were written by local Aleut leaders in 1963 and 64 and at Tunner Times. In 1965, or at that time, 64, a Human Rights Commission investigation, 65, congressional investigation, that the things really changed. Today, the economic base is uncertain.
You mean specifically that the Aleuts as a separate group, apart from any other Alaskan native claims, had special issues as
right.
a population.
Dr. Helen Shenitz, then the head of State Historical Library, in those years that Larry refers to, wrote an article on the rights for the Pribilovians. And my understanding is she made several speeches before United States Congress, and when the statehood issue came up, Dr. Helen Shenitz saw to it that rights for the Pribilovians were being written into the Alaska Republican Party charter. She was one of the first fighters in the States for the rights of the people in the Pribilofs, and it's absolutely correct. Aleuts on the Pribilof Islands had very special problems in terms of preservation of their civil rights.
Yes, and even I remember some of those occurrences, and I'm 35 years old, but I remember the government doctor going house to house inspecting the homes for sanitation. I remember my parents having to go to the government agent to ask permission to leave the island. And I remember people being, and the food being rationed. Those kinds of things. I mean, this is fairly recently in our
history. What did your father do to make a living? What kind of life did your mother and father have?
Well, I think they were very poor, like most families were at that point in time. And I didn't realize we were poor, but I found out subsequently in looking back to it that we were. My dad worked in the seal harvest operation most of his life. That was the only source of employment on the island.
And is that what you expected to do when you grew up?
No, when I grew up, everyone around me said, we've got to change our conditions. We cannot continue being controlled by the federal government. Larry, you got to go out and get your schooling and come back and help us.
You were educated in the primary grades?
On St. Paul through 10th grade.
Through 10th grade, and then where did you go?
To Chemehuevin Indian School for my sophomore year, and then Mount Edgecombe High School, where I graduated in 67, then off to University of Washington.
And that is the story for what percentage of people your age did? I mean, do many go out to school? Do many Aleuts leave and make that transition?
Yeah, I think so, particularly in the industrial trades. There are a lot of people that go out. In fact, on a per capita basis, we probably have more skilled people in the industrial trades than any other place in Alaska or Bush, Alaska.
So then they return to the islands.
Yeah.
They live there close to 200 years. It's their home. And my point has been for many years. How many of us can say that our ancestors lived in the same place close to 200 years? It's home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an amazing feeling. I'm glad you brought that up, because when I go out there hunting or I go out fishing, I'm thinking about that. I'm doing exactly what my ancestors did, mm-hmm. and probably walking over the very same piece of land and feeling the same weather and looking out the same kinds of waters and having the same kinds of feelings inside of me that my ancestors had 200 years ago.
And people want to be buried at home. And I know a father of a friend of mine died in Arizona, and his body was brought to St. Paul for burial.
Mm. It's definitely very deep. I mean, I just came from Seattle recently, and there are a lot of Aleuts down there that moved down there after the World War II. And all of them say they, one of these days, are going to come back to the island.
Strong cases of homesickness.
Oh, definitely.
And this is a long-standing pattern. In 1865, Nikolai Belkov, who was the steward of the Orthodox mission on the Yukon by his own choice, who was the head of the carpenter crew who built the first church on the Yukon, knowing that he is ill and aged, he went home to St. Paul and so that he could be buried home.
We were talking the last time we had a conversation about how special that environment is. It's not an environment that can be replaced easily. It's so unique. You can't go somewhere and have it be like home.
That's so true. I mean, it's like St. Paul. It's an island that's 12 miles long, 5 miles wide, and we're in the middle of the Bering Sea. We've got 1 million seals and 3 million birds and a wildness and pristineness that you can't find anywhere else.
What are the plans that the corporation has for?
Well, we're facing some very difficult challenges. We've been a government-run company town, and basically until October of 83, which is a little over a year ago, then the government pulled out lock, stock, and barrel, eliminating 70% of the wage base, all the support for the critical infrastructure that runs the island, even the check cashing systems. And so we've had to plan everything from scratch. Now we're trying to move in a new economic base and it's going to be overnight. We're changing something that existed for generations in terms of skills and activity. Overnight, we're going to develop a port out there, and it's going to be fully functional, hopefully by the end of this year. But we have got a target. We must become self-sustaining. within the next 2 to 3 years, or the village is going to die. That's our challenge. And our corporation is doing everything we can to work with all the organizations and the people to achieve this goal.
To create a self-sufficient economy,
mm-hmm.
where your people can work and yeah. live there without going outside. That certainly is a challenge, and the distances are great, but we seem to be in a shrinking world, and I suppose that has its both benefits and detractions for your people.
Yeah, particularly, until we get the port mobilized fully functional, the first seal harvest that's out there now provides a great deal of food supplement to our people as well as employment. And because it's such a controversial thing, media being what it is, we've had CBS, PBS, NBC, ABC, New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, I mean, you name it, we've had them up there in the Pribilof Islands. And this year we're going to hit all the media again, Associated Press, UPI. I mean, all these are probably going to be up there because Greenpeace is now involved, and they're going to do activist demonstrations on St. Paul. The U.S. Humane Society is probably going to file lawsuits to try to stop us from doing the seal harvest. There's going to be a big battle in Congress over the renewal of the first seal treaty. And what's at risk here is our ability to continue using seal meat for food and to provide jobs for almost 50% of the employable population on the island.
It is also at stake is, of course, the well-being of the herd, because if the convention is not supported, if it falls by the wayside, pelagic sealing can proceed again, and it is abrogation of this convention is not going to serve anybody's interests, not the seals, to be sure.
And it's not very well, that's very true, and thank you for bringing that up. It is not very well known, for example, that we have reputable environmental groups on our side. The National Audubon Society supports us in continuation of the treaty. The International Wildlife Fund, International Association for Fish and Wildlife Agencies, the National Wildlife Federation.
Sierra Club.
And all these are reputable groups that see the need to maintain this treaty, because if the treaty is not maintained, we are going to jeopardize and threaten the seal herds.
Obviously, the fortunes of the Aleut seem inextricably tied to the fortunes of the seals, and this conversation has seemed like a skipping stone over the surface of a lake. There's so much to material to mine here. We've simply glossed over a lot of years of history and culture, but I hope we have a little better understanding of what life is like out on the Aleutian chain. I thank you very much, Larry Merkulov.
Thank you.
And Lydia Black for joining me and sharing with our audience a little more information about part of our state. Thank you very much. I've been Patty Kostelic, your host for Home Fires. Our executive producer is Carla Tanella. Have a very good day.